Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and I have a great guest today. I'm not going to tell you his name yet, but he's actually the nation's largest syndicated columnist. So chew on that for a little bit. And he's really an old friend never met. I've worked with him indirectly in a variety of ways going back some time. But before actually introducing him, I want to tell you about a new upcoming conference. Our Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy is co-sponsoring a conference just 2 months from now. On Friday, February 28th, I'll be speaking in the morning and emceeing the afternoon. And the following day, March 1st, I'll be doing a workshop. The conference is the Adlerian Society of Florida, probably the best way to Google it. And it's co-sponsored by us, the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy. And the conference is on empathic relationships. They're good friends. We've worked on the conference together. Now, on the Thursday, which is February 29th, the conference actually, on Thursday, February 27th, which is when the conference actually begins, they'll have special workshops. I think that will be of most interest to Adlerian psychologists and people who want to learn about Adlerian psychology, which has a psychology, say, compared to Freud or Jung or Rogers or whatever, is probably one of the very best because it's socially based. The importance of human social relationships. I was very much influenced by Adler by reading his books when I was younger. And so it's a natural relationship. So look out for the Adlerian Society meetings, February 27th, 28th, 29th, and I'll be very active there on the 28th and the 29th, 2014. It's in Florida at Safety Harbor. I've been there before at their conferences. Safety Harbor is right on Tampa Bay, and it's a great place to go. So treat it exactly as you would one of our empathic therapy conferences done on our own, because this is a co-sponsored conference. We're going to be doing more and more co-sponsored conferences to reach out to other groups and also not to put so much pressure on my wife, Ginger, to run the entire show. So my guest is John Roseman. John, are you there?
I am, Peter. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, it's so good to have you here. Let me tell you a little bit about John. He's syndicated to around 225 newspapers nationwide. Makes me jealous. He's written 11 best-selling parenting books. He's a very busy, popular speaker. So really a pleasure that he has time for us. He gives a lot of good advice. He's just a good man. But beyond that, he doesn't buy the medical psychiatric model. And that's how he and I started doing things together long distance. I think he covered one of the earliest people to cover me in the national press. He's been on shows almost as prestigious as the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. He's been on 2020, Good Morning America, The View. God, I would love to see that. The Today Show, CNN, and lots of other things. John, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Peter. I appreciate the invitation.
Where would you like to begin? Well, first, what's your newest book?
My newest book is a book called Parent Babble, and the original subtitle was How the Experts Ruined Parenting in America. Unfortunately, I, in retrospect, unfortunately agreed to a change of the subtitle because my publisher thought it was too negative, and I've told them that when we go to paperback, I want the original subtitle restored, How the Experts Ruined Parenting in America. And the reason I wrote the book was to really do an in-depth analysis of the failed psychological theory that has driven American parenting since the late 1960s. When most young people don't realize, we completely in America changed our parenting paradigm in less than 10 years. And it was what I call a psychological parenting revolution. And we replaced common sense with psychological theory. And we are paying a terrible price in America in terms of the behavior of children, primarily, and also the anxiety of the American mother that she typically brings to the process of child rearing for having embraced this new psychologically theory-grounded parenting paradigm 40 or 50 years ago.
Well, let's talk about it. You know, we're not afraid of negative here. I really would like you to talk more about the loss of common sense in parenting and the direction that you feel parenting needs to go. I think this is incredibly important stuff.
Well, you know, parenting, the way children are raised defines culture. And if we raise children one way, culture turns out that way. If we raise children another way, culture goes in a different direction. And we, the new paradigm that we embraced, Peter, involves three primary features. And interestingly enough, as you're going to undoubtedly agree, in academia, these schools of theoretical thought are antagonistic, and they were cobbled together into a hybrid that I call postmodern psychological parenting. First of all, you have the humanistic component, the centerpiece of which is the entirely specious idea that high self-esteem is something desirable and that we should do everything we can to help children acquire it. I'm certain that there are a number of listeners out there whose jaws have dropped down to their waists at this point in time, but the fact is that this body of theory concerning high self-esteem was proposed before any credible research had been done into the issue whatsoever. And now the research has been done, and without exception, the research indicates that high self-esteem exposes a person to a lot of emotional vulnerability. It's associated with, for children, low performance in school, and ironically, schools were sold this on the basis of the belief that if we raise the self-esteem of children, their school performance will come up. Exactly the opposite has occurred. High self-esteem, people with high self-esteem are more vulnerable to depression. In terms of respect for others, they have low respect for others. It's been a complete and total bust. And I tell people, you know, I'm a fully functional human being. I've got my faults, issues, whatever people want to call them these days. But I'm a fully functional, responsible citizen. And I'm a member of the last generation of American children who weren't allowed to have high self-esteem. I'm certain that you'll be able to relate to being told by your parents that you were acting too big for your britches. You were up on your high horse, reminding you that you were a little fish in a big pond. And we don't talk like this to children anymore. It's what I call psychologically incorrect speech. And again, our children are paying a terrible price. There is absolutely no indication statistically that new parenting has advanced the mental health of children whatsoever.
Wow. So give me a definition of high self-esteem, just a word. This is not a challenge. It's just to get a working idea about what you think is wrong with it. You've kind of defined what you think is better, which is a certain degree, it sounds like, of shaming. I mean, that it sounds like a certain degree of shaming and certainly a perspective that the world doesn't revolve around you, which is, God knows, a very important perspective. But it sounds like a little bit of shaming, too. So talk to me about what you see self-esteem as and what you see as the better way for folks to view themselves, if you can, John.
Well, first of all, let me deal with the issue of shaming. There's really nothing inherently wrong with feeling ashamed. There are pathological extremes. People who feel no shame about anything they do are called sociopaths. People who feel shame about everything they do are called neurotics. But people who feel an appropriate degree of shame when they have offended someone else, that is a perfectly functional and necessary social attribute. It keeps us attuned to the needs of other people. And what I'm really talking about is in terms of self-esteem, is the opposite, not of low self-esteem, but is the opposite of humility. And humility is simply an attitude of service toward other people, where you pay attention to the needs of other people, you're attuned to the needs of other people, you respond appropriately to the needs of other people, you anticipate the needs of other people. It's about the other person. And people with high self-esteem, the research has clearly indicated, it's not about the other person, it's about themselves. It is a self-focused personal attribute, whereas humility is an other-focused attribute. And I maintain what common sense would validate, which is that culture is stronger and more functional when people, when the overwhelming majority of people in the culture are other-focused and not self-focused.
Wow, this is so interesting. I tend to agree with a lot of it. I'm interested and puzzled by some aspects of it. I certainly think that the good life is not about self-love, but love for others, for nature, for your ideals, for God. So I certainly agree that what's happened in our culture is that people have tried to bring up their children with unearned self-worth. And maybe that's is that similar to what you're thinking of as self-esteem, a kind of a unearned self-worth where you exist and you're entitled?
Well, going back to the research, and I do, you know, Peter, agree that a good change of vernacular for this, substitute vernacular, would be unearned self-worth and entitlement. The research indicates that people with high self-esteem have an entitlement mentality that is, in fact, when you analyze it, very close to the mentality of a toddler. What I want, I deserve to have. No one has a right to stand in my way. The rules don't apply to me. The ends justify the means. It's a very pragmatic and self-focused entitlement attitude. And, one of the things I point out to my audiences is, you know, we were presented, and I was in graduate school at the time, and I'm intimately familiar with the presentation. I was a straight-A student. I swallowed all of this stuff hook, line, and sinker. And we were presented this on the basis that all of this would improve humanity and make us more emotionally resilient and so on. And exactly the opposite has occurred. What we have in America is, among young people especially, is a rampant entitlement mentality. And this is not a mentality that is going to sustain the strength of culture in any sort of functional way.
100% agreement on this. I guess what's puzzling to me, and maybe confusing to the listeners to some extent, is the choice of the concept, the association of the concept of self-esteem with a kind of a self-centered, narcissistic, entitlement viewpoint. And I think of that more as unearned self-esteem, maybe, where a person is brought up to think that without doing anything or accomplishing anything, they should get everything. The spoiled child concept, but the child is spoiled in the sense that they get everything without effort and without appreciation, but they don't get loved, which is my notion of how people get spoiled. So I think the in-your-face part of it that's a little difficult is the equation of self-esteem with all these negatives. Now, is there a core self-esteem concept that one starts with before attaching to it all the negatives? Is there like you're going to study people with self-esteem, is there a core way of identifying what that is and then deciding it's got all these negative things associated?
Peter, I'm following you. I'm tracking along with you here. There, part of the problem here is the language people's.
Yeah.
I think they accept the terminology without really analyzing what it means at a concrete level. The term self-esteem, an adequate substitute synonym would be self-admiration. And mm-hmm. what I believe is the functional, not equivalent, but the functional, we'll say substitute for this, is a sense that you are capable, and you can call it self-value, self-worth, but it is the sense that you are capable, regardless of your specific abilities, regardless of your IQ, regardless of what side of the tracks you grew up on, regardless of your parentage, your race, your height, your weight, you're capable of making a valuable contribution to society, to your fellow man. So, again, we go from self-admiration, which is a preoccupation with one's own self, and a
right.
value of the self independent of any external verification, to the concept of self-worth, which is other-directed, that, you know, I'm a capable person. I'm capable of being a good garbage man. I'm capable of being a good accountant. I'm capable of being a good neighbor. I'm capable of just being a good person. And being a good person does not involve necessarily making straight A's in school. Being a good person involves when your neighbor is sick and in bed, you take him his dinner as a casserole or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's self-esteem versus self-worth. I'm tracking with you completely there, Peter, absolutely.
Yeah. This is all very, very interesting. I've just finished this week a manuscript that I'm calling A Little Book About Love and Life. And one of the fundamental themes is that we get our strength through love of others and love of life. And I compared it to having an extremely bright light, which when you shine on others, illuminates the room and the world around you. But if you try to shine that light of love on yourself, it blinds you. So the metaphor that sort of goes along with what you're describing here. One of the places that we may differ, and this is just a theory that I've been evolving, and that's in the new little book, and which I think I'm going to have a terrible time getting published. All the signs are going to have a terrible time getting it published. They have to self-publish it. And that is that guilt, shame, and anxiety are fundamentally the product of evolution's attempt to deal with the fact that we human beings are the most violent creature on Earth and the most social. So how do you take the most violent creature on Earth and the most social and raise them in intimacy? And evolution evolved in us the capacity to shut down our self-assertion and aggression, including plain old self-assertion, with guilt, shame, and anxiety, and that it serves this evolutionary function. Maybe it's a helpful thing in childhood, but as adults, we need to learn to guide ourselves by reason, ethics, and love. A lot of emphasis on love, reason, ethics, and love, rather than guilt, shame, and anxiety. So that's a model that I have in this little book. Does that make sense to you, or does it? You really think we need guilt, shame, and anxiety as mature adults?
Well, I think if you accept the premise, and it may be a difference in premises. My premise is that you cannot perfect the human being, that we are going to do bad things, and that the mechanism that is required in order to for us, when we do bad things, to recognize that we have insulted our neighbor, we have offended someone, we have transgressed, et cetera, is guilt, it's shame. And that causes us to make restitution, to make apology, to make up for whatever it is we did in whatever way. If you accept that the human being can be perfected, then you would say that guilt of any sort is pathological. And my premise is that guilt in and of itself is not, but there are extremes that certainly are.
This is really interesting. Do you mind if we spend a little more time on it right now?
No, not at all, Peter. I'm enjoying it.
It's very interesting because it's something that I've literally been, I've two books out about it, one academic, more academic, sitting at a publisher, and then my little book about love. I'm labeling guilt, shame, and anxiety negative legacy emotions, that they're inherited and that they're prehistoric. They're prehistoric in two senses. One, they were evolved during evolution to control our aggressive and self-assertive impulses within the intimacy of our families, which is how we always lived as creatures. And they're prehistoric in that we cannot even recall where we learned most of our guilt, shame, and anxiety in childhood. So it's like an instinctual drive we have built in to feel guilt, shame, and anxiety. It gets elicited, stimulated, modified during childhood, but largely, well, totally out of our control, totally dependent on the upbringing we have, and totally out of our awareness, most of it having happened unconsciously during a time when we can't remember. And even if we start looking at it when we reach 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, we still may not remember, or we'll have distorted versions of it. And the way I look at it as a therapist is that you can have a very good, basically sound, loving person who gets guilty over the slightest fantasy of aggression, and you can have murderers who don't feel guilty at all because they're operating on shame, which was made them kill somebody who disrespected them on the highway. So I'm viewing guilt, shame, and anxiety as random by the time we get to be mature. It just hits us for reasons that may or may not bear some legitimacy to our behavior, and that ultimately how we need to live is by reason, ethics, and love. So that's my model. It's so much fun to actually announce it on the air, is what I've been working on and now looking for publishers for. It's, on the other hand, I agree with you that human beings are imperfect. I mean, that's one of all themes, is we're built imperfect. How do we manage it and transcend it to the best of our ability?
Well, I think we're talking about the same thing, Peter. We're just using somewhat different language and a somewhat different intellectual point of beginning, if you will. But I think we're talking about the same thing. When you talk about irrational anxiety, irrational guilt. That's what I meant before when I said that people who feel extremes of guilt for no reason whatsoever, they're called neurotic. And people, you use the example of the criminal, people who feel no guilt at all, regardless of how offensive their behavior, transgressive their behavior may be toward another human being, those people are sociopathic. So, yeah, we're talking about the same thing. And absolutely.
Well, I'm not sure, John. I think we may have a little different idea. For example, let me give you an example, and this you would know well. In therapy, we find all the time that there are people who can't speak up for themselves in their marriages, can't speak up at work, because they're going to be afflicted with either guilt, shame, or anxiety, and the two different events may afflict them different, will afflict people totally differently, even though, because they're just primed for different kinds of guilt, for different kinds of responses. For example, a man loses his job. One man's going to feel horribly guilty, he's a bad man. Another man's going to feel terribly anxious, he's not going to be able to support his family. Another man's going to be ashamed to tell his wife. So you got guilt, shame, and anxiety swirling around. I think it's a random event from our evolution and our early childhood, and that they mostly interfere with reason and love. So I certainly don't believe in perfectibility, but I believe that the striving should be not to respond to guilt, shame, or anxiety, but to evaluate it in the light of reason and love and to make those your guidelines. Interesting.
So, like I said, I think we're just, you know, starting from two different intellectual beginnings.
Very interesting. Now, you're a psychologist, right?
Yes, I am a psychologist. I'm, you know, licensed in the state of North Carolina.
What kind of, tell me in a word, and then we're going to go to break. What kind of practice do you have? Do you practice?
I do, on a limited basis, Peter. I do a lot of public speaking and a lot of writing. I write the newspaper column that's syndicated that you were gracious enough to mention earlier. I've written 18 books, and I'm always in the middle of writing a book or two or three. And the amount of time that I can devote to private practice is fairly minimal. I might see 3 to 5 clients in a good week, and some weeks and even some months I don't see anybody at all. I use a short-term therapy, very directive, problem solution-oriented model, and don't see anybody with any sort of overt, outstanding psychiatric or psychological issues. I don't see people with dysfunctional marriages. I see people with just garden variety everyday parenting problems. The 5-year-old child who won't do what he's told, the teenager who is screaming at his parents on a daily basis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Can people, by looking up John Roseman, you're very easy to Google, his last name, folks, is Rosemond, R-O-S-E-M-O-N-D. Can they get your phone number or somebody to get in touch with you if they'd like some parenting consultations?
Yeah, sure. So you can go to my website, which is at Rosemond or johnrosemond.com. And there's phone numbers, there's email links, and so on and so forth. It's not difficult to get in touch with me. Let me talk just a little bit, Peter.
We're going to go to break. What would you like to read? What do you want to come back to when we come back?
Behavior modification and the scam of behavior modification.
Oh, I'd love to talk about it when we get back. And maybe ADHD and Ritalin and stuff, but of course we talk about that a fair amount here. Folks, this is John Roseman, a marvelous man, a brave, ethical, direct, good psychologist. We'll return to him after the break and a little music and other things. This is Dr. Peter Bregan, And I'm on the air with John Rosemond. We're having a really interesting conversation. If you missed the first half hour, John has challenged very cogently the whole concept of self-esteem. And now, John, I think you want to challenge the concept of behavior mod.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier that this parenting paradigm that I refer to as postmodern psychological parenting has three major theoretical features to it, the first being the humanistic feature, which we covered, I think, adequately in the first half hour. And the second feature is the, again, specious notion that the same principles that govern the behavior of a rat or a dog also govern the behavior of a human being. And the American parent was propagandized in the late 60s and early 70s to the effect that behavior modification theory, if brought to bear on the behavior of children, could solve any and all behavior problems. And we embraced a behavior modification-based disciplinary paradigm at that point in time in our parenting history. And it's been a complete bust, Peter. Today's children are doing things that our great-grandparents would never have imagined children doing. Our great-grandparents could never have imagined a child of 5 years old defiantly telling his parents that he was not going to pick up his toys or obey whatever instruction they had given him. And we have, by embracing a disciplinary paradigm that doesn't work with human beings, we have created behavior problems rather than solved any. One of the things I say to my audiences is, if we had never stopped, I'm not saying that the people in question were perfect parents by any means. Sometimes people say that I idealize the old days, that I've got some golden years fantasy going on. No. I'm fully aware that human beings are faulted, that they are not capable of being perfected. But I think that there is validity to the idea, and statistics support this, that children were better off, that childhood was a happier time 60, 70-plus years ago. One of the things I say to my audiences is that if we had never stopped listening to our elders tell us how to raise kids, we'd be in much better shape in parenting in America today. This does not apply across the board. There are people out there listening to us who would say to themselves, and truthfully so, well, my parents couldn't have given me very good advice at all. But I'm talking about overall. Since we began listening to mental health professionals tell us how to raise kids, and we disconnected ourselves from family tradition in the raising of children, and stopped listening to and giving credence to the advice given to us by our elders, the mental health of the American child has nosedived precipitously. By most estimates, today's child, by age 16, is, when compared with a child raised in the 1950s or before, 10 times more likely by age 16 to experience a serious emotional setback. And, again, there's just no indication whatsoever that people with capital letters after their names in your profession and mine have advanced the state of parenting in America one iota. You don't successfully discipline children by manipulating consequences. Consequences are important. But what mediates a consequence for a child is choice. A child can choose to ignore a consequence, no matter how negative. There is plenty of evidence to the effect that punishment with children often backfires, and there is plenty of evidence to the equal effect that rewarding children for proper behavior often backfires. The way you discipline a child is through the calm, collected, determined, purposeful demonstration of leadership in the child's life. One of the things I'm constantly...
By the way, I love what you just said.
Well, thank you.
I really, really like what you're saying. Go ahead, please.
Well, this is the way children were disciplined before the psychological revolution. Parents understood that parenting is a leadership function. It requires ethical leadership. It requires loving leadership. It requires selfless leadership. And the well put together functional parent, this is how they disciplined their child. It was not a methods based discipline. It was an attitude based discipline. And the child saw this parent who radiated this confidence in their ability to steer this child's life in a positive direction, and the child's trust in the parent's emanation of proper authority was what disciplined the child. And now we're trying to discipline children by using methodologies, and it just isn't working, Peter, and we're forgetting how to act like leaders in our children's lives and how to emanate this positive leadership that causes children to trust us and to follow our lead.
Folks, this is the absolute truth. I call it moral authority, moral persuasion. The people who come to see me in trouble raising their children, by and large, have no sense that they're supposed to be the moral leaders of their children. In fact, they now assume their children won't listen to them and that they have to manipulate them with rewards and punishments, which only make the children feel more alienated from them. The kids see through it right away. They lose any sense of intrinsic value to work or studying because they're responding to the manipulations. In fact, the very idea of rewarding children for good grades makes them think that it's not a satisfaction in itself, that it's something all extrinsic.
Precisely, so, Peter. And when you are manipulated, you learn how to manipulate.
Exactly.
And this is not a pro-social way in the final analysis of disciplining children. They learn how to manipulate other people, and effectively so, by being manipulated by their parents.
Yeah. You know, John, what you're saying, since you and I are older than probably the vast majority of our listeners, it's so important for us as old folks here. It's interesting that I should never call myself old folks. I certainly don't feel or act like one. But we have knowledge, and one of the knowledge that you're communicating and I want to share is that when I was in high school, which was 1950 through 1954, I had many friends. I was actually president of the class more years than not, and I knew a lot of people in the class, a wide circle of friends. We didn't have kids going through nervous breakdowns. We didn't have kids having violent encounters very often with other kids, and certainly never with weapons. When there was a fight, once the other person was hurt, you stopped. You'd won. We didn't have a lot of cheating in class. We were quiet in the assembly and quiet in our classes, depending on what level of expectation the teacher had for noise. The whole environment of the school felt safe and under control of adults.
Exactly. We didn't have girls starving themselves, being hospitalized because they weigh 90 pounds.
Nope.
You know, it's something that the listener needs to appreciate, is that we put a lot of trust in postmodernity, in experts, and there are certainly experts who qualify for valid trust, but there is absolutely no indication, unfortunately, and I'm talking about our professions, that a reliance on psychological experts in parenting has paid off for the American child. I met a friend of mine, went to high school with, a guy I'd gone to high school with a few years back, told him what I was doing. The high school we went to was Proviso West High School in the western suburbs of Chicago. And I went to high school from 61 to 65. And he was fascinated by what I did and was asking me questions about, you know, my point of view, my philosophy, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, "It sounds like you believe that children were raised better in the 1950s and early 60s. And I said, "Well, statistically, that is, you know, strongly what the statistics strongly indicate." And he looked at me skeptically, and I said, "Michael, we went to a high school of 5,000 kids. Did you know any kids who hit a teacher? No. Did you know any kids who committed suicide? No. And this is in 4 years. Did you know any girls who starved themselves to the point of having to be hospitalized? No. Did you know of any kids who had to be removed from school for nervous breakdowns? No. Did you know any kid who abused alcohol? Drugs weren't an issue at that point in time, not in our area of the country anyway, but who abused alcohol to the point where he had to be taken out of school and rehabilitated? No. I said, "Michael, every kid in every high school, large and small in America today, knows of a kid in every single one of those categories. This is how bad it's gotten for the American child. And we're like a nation of ostriches. We've got our heads in the sand. We're not willing to face up to this and realize that we are in a mental health crisis concerning the American child, and that the mental health paradigm that we continue to seek out when we have problems with our children is the very paradigm that created these problems in the first place, that we really need to begin forming parent communities in America, parent support communities and parent support networks, and coming together in agreement on how we want to raise American children in order to sustain a strong American culture."
John, there is a group. Ginger and I are on the advisory council of Mother Bear Can, Mother Bear C-A-N. You can Google it, folks. And it's an attempt to replace NAMI, the National Alliance of the Mentally Ill, for parents who have troubled kids, and to regain parental authority rather than doing what NAMI does, which is use parental authority to send kids off for drugs, shock, lobotomy, and involuntary treatment. Literally.
Yeah.
That's what NAMI does. And so we have an alternative group, and the principles are about empowering the parents, not the professionals. They use my work and the work of a lot of other really good people, and it's Mother Bear Can, C-A-N. There may be a way, John, that you can get involved with that. We can communicate back and forth about that. Go ahead, John.
Well, you know, here's another thought that occurred to me. And these are dangerous things, I believe. I'm reading the Wall Street Journal the other day, and there's this very laudatory editorial about and I don't have it in front of me. I didn't anticipate that I would talk about this, but a very laudatory editorial in the Wall Street Journal concerning a congressman from the state of Pennsylvania, Republican. He himself is a psychologist who has proposed legislation that would create a new department, governmental department, that would be headed by a person who is either a psychiatrist or a psychologist. That would be a requirement. And here was the interesting thing, that this proposed department would promote, actively promote, and this is what blew my mind, the medical model. And my first question was, what drug company is paying this guy off?
Right.
Because,
right.
I mean, and here's the Wall Street Journal promoting this as though this is the way we need to go in America, and the whole substance of this was that this is what's going to prevent school shootings and the type of shooting that occurred, Representative Giffords in Arizona, that if we can identify these people and adequately medicate them, that we can lower the level of you know, psychiatric violence in America. And people just don't understand in America, I don't think, Peter, the how the law of unintended consequences works where these kinds of things are concerned.
Yeah. Just as a fact, almost every single perpetrator of school violence and most perpetrators of mass violence, almost every one of them, have been through the psychiatric mill. Many of them on psychiatric drugs at the time, and the rest of them victims of the psychiatric abusive system. So they've all been through the system. That can't be a coincidence.
And, no, it's not a coincidence at all.
You know, the shooter at the Naval Yard had just recently, within weeks, been in to see VA psychiatry and had been put on an antidepressant, trazodone. The shooter at Newtown, every indication is that he was on psychiatric drugs, and that the state of Connecticut has been gotten to by the drug companies and won't release that information. One of the attorneys for the state at a hearing demanding the information said, well, it might stop people from taking their drugs. Big hint, he was on psychiatric drugs. And so the psychiatric system has got its hands all over just about every single mass shooter in America. It's bizarre.
Yeah. Another thing that, you know, we were talking about the high school experience that we had. 1 year of high school, I spent, my parents had been divorced, and I went to live with my father in Valdosta, Georgia for a year. During that year, I took up hunting, because this is what all the kids in Valdosta, the boys, did. And during duck season, we would wake up in the morning, put on our school clothes, put on our duck hunting clothes, go out duck hunt before sunrise. And then we would come back to the school. We would take off in the school parking lot. And by the way, all the teachers, the principal, everybody knew this. We would take off our hunting clothes, throw them in the trunks of our cars. We had our school clothes on underneath. We would throw our guns, not throw, but place our guns in the trunks of our cars. We would close the trunks of our cars. Peter, on at Valdosta High School, and I've talked to a lot of people our age who say, oh, yeah, we did the same thing. There were guns all over American high school parking lots in the 1960s. Were there any school shootings? Absolutely not. Were there kids on psychiatric drugs? No. Now, coincidence does not prove causation, but it's certainly an interesting, combination of facts.
Well, I just have no doubt that the worst thing now in America on an institutional level that can happen to a child is to get in the grips of my colleagues in psychiatry. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. It's a
absolutely
humiliating and destructive system.
My a friend of yours and I think you know Dr. DuBose Ravenel from High Point, North Carolina.
Sure.
And DuBose and I wrote a book. We researched it for 10 years. I'll put a little push in here, a little pump. The book is called The Diseasing of America's Children. And this was the subject of the book, is how the psychiatric and psychological industries in America are have their you know, this may sound somewhat emotionally exaggerated, but it's really not, are looking to put as many diagnose and put as many kids onto psychiatric medications as they possibly can. And America's public schools, unfortunately, are unwittingly acting as their handmaidens.
Well, I don't even know how unwitting it is. You know, it's an easy solution to incompetent teachers and out-of-control children, which is not always the teacher's fault, but we've been looking at other reasons for it. But it's an easy solution. I don't think it's that unwitting. You know, everybody says they're doing things for a good purpose, but these teachers who are calling for the drugging of their children and are not self-examining on that, I hold them responsible for that.
But well, I'm trying to be as kind as I possibly can.
Yes,
be, Peter.
You are. Yeah. But, you know, the real villains here are psychiatry and the pharmaceutical industry. Psychiatry is totally supported now by the pharmaceutical industry. They are one industry, inseparable now and forever. And without psychiatry and the pharmaceutical industry collaborating like that, I don't think all the pediatricians and internists and family docs and everybody else, nurse practitioners and so on, would be falling in lockstep. And psychiatry is never going to change. It's gotten too much power this way, too much money. And I think the public is just going to have to learn that it's unsafe to go to psychiatrists, and particularly unsafe to bring your children.
Well, I think it's unsafe to take your children to public schools these days. When you talk to people that I talk to all across America and discover things like in one Alabama fifth grade class in an upper middle class area of Alabama, 56% of the kids are on psychiatric medication, most of them on ADHD medication. That's completely outrageous. Now, but the problem is
that that's the worst statistic I've ever heard. Do you have some data for that?
The only data I have is the principal who told me this, and he himself was amazed by it. But what happens in the upper middle class today, Peter? I mean, you know this. What happens in the upper middle class? The minute a parent has a problem with a child, they run to a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and they get their kid on drugs, and they think this is a solution. It's not only the incompetent teacher that's the problem here. It's the parent who doesn't want to deal with the child's misbehavior, would rather just medicate the child, thinking this is the appropriate way to handle the situation, whatever the situation may be.
Yeah. The most important force in society ultimately is the family. It's battered sociologically by politics and culture and everything else. But the solution is going to be in parents hearing this message. Parents, hear this message. Therapists, pass on this message. It's the moral authority of the parents that has to be reinstated in America. Does that
Absolutely.
Sum it up pretty well?
Yep. One last comment. I tell people, parents, I say you need to act like superior beings. And I had a parent the other day say, oh, John, that sounds like, you know, some dictatorial thing. And I said, no. You're simply acting, and I'm going to use your terminology now, as if you have legitimate moral authority where this child is concerned. And I said to the parent, I said, who do you think, using their name, who do you think was the superior, is or was the superior being? The Jonathan Smith made up name referring to the parent, the Jonathan Smith of today, or the Jonathan Smith of when Jonathan Smith was 5 years old? And he looked at me and he said, well, I'm superior to the 5 year old me. And I said, well, that's what I'm talking about.
You are not only
superior to the 5 year old you, you are superior to the 5 year old your child. Act like it.
Oh, gosh. I hope people are listening. It's incredibly important. And as you know, John, if a child doesn't think his parents are superior human beings, the child lives in terror because the strength that a child ultimately feels is from the strength of the parents who protect and guide.
Absolutely. A child's sense of well-being depends on this.
Absolutely depends on it. The alternative to knowing your mom and dad can be trusted to know better than you as a child is a state of constant anxiety and difficulty controlling your own aggressive and impulsive nature because you just don't know the difference between right and wrong, and you just don't know that you need the guidance of your parents. This is so
precisely
important. Well, we're coming to an end. John Rosemond, R-O-S-E-M-O-N-D, the nation's most widely circulated columnist. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Peter, thank you for inviting me, and open invitation from me. I'll do this anytime. It was very enjoyable.
Very good.